Welcome to Disability Empowerment Now, Season 3. I'm your host, Keith Murphy DiConcini. Today I'm talking to Cherry Bookstop, a biology professor and brain tumor survivor. Cherry, welcome to the show. So tell us a bit about yourself and the impact of empathy.
Well, as you said, I'm a biology professor. I'm actually a marine biology professor. As you can see, I have lots of whale and dolphin stuff around me. And then 17 years ago in 2006, I just started getting dizzy and nauseous out of the blue. It took 4 months for doctors to take me seriously enough to send me for an MRI, and they found a tumor that hadn't been removed right away. They said that it would be an easy tumor to remove. They actually called it routine, but then something happened, probably a stroke after surgery, and I was not able to recover as quickly as I thought. And I've had lifelong disabilities to deal with since then. Impact of empathy came about when I wanted to make an impact on healthcare people and healthcare workers and professionals, because some of them were not as giving of empathy as I felt they should have been given my situation. So what I did was I founded a nonprofit, a Lifetime of Impact, where I went and I still operate that nonprofit. I go to schools and go to classes of healthcare students and talk to them and share my story and give them practical tips for connecting to patients immediately. And then later I found an Impact of Empathy, a business to expand on that expression of empathy to, you know, healthcare professionals and everybody, like leaders who should lead with empathy. Anybody who has any contact with other humans should really be able to work in empathy into their daily interactions.
So I think you already answered this, but just to double back, how did you come up with the name Impact of Empathy, and could you explain it in more depth, if there is more depth to that title?
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of depth. I mean, I love the word. I think that empathy is something that everybody in our society needs to exhibit. Amen. And empathy can have a huge impact. When I first came up with a Lifetime of Impact, where that came from was in a moment of care, a healthcare professional can have a lifetime of impact. I'm telling stories now from medical professionals who, you know, 17 years ago did something that positively influenced my life. And it's a forever kind of impact. So it really is a lifetime of impact. So where that came from was, you know, in a moment of genuine care, you can have a lifetime of positive impact. And that impact comes from expressing empathy. So Impact of Empathy was a natural came to naturally from Lifetime Impact.
So again, just to double back, why did you choose medical professionals as the target of the program?
Right. Well, the experiences that I had when I was, you know, a brain surgery patient, some of the nurses were really nice and kind, and some actually like scolded me for pressing my button too much, or some of the doctors would come in and do really invasive, painful, you know, tests to me and then leave me in an uncomfortable position, not caring what I was going to be left with. And, you know, and I had a lot of that unempathetic treatment And I had some, you know, really great treatment, but I thought that it was enough of an unempathetic treatment. And when I started talking to other people, other patients, and I'm sure you've experienced it too, that some medical professionals are just not very empathetic. And I thought that that was a really critical, you know, skill for them to have and to be able to express empathy, because patients are so vulnerable and so helpless and so much in pain. And, you know, and I came through this brain surgery having a voice. And I felt like I had a voice. I've been a teacher for 30 years. I had a voice. I did not have a fear of speaking. And I really felt like I wanted to make an impact for other patients who don't have that voice. So I want, that's mainly what I wanted to do, is make an impact on a community that I could serve.
Very good. So let's transition to, you're not only a biology professor, you're a marine biology professor. I always love to know what triggers, for lack of a better word, people's passions. Like, what is the genesis? What is the inception of where a person first encounters their passion, and when did they know it was their passion and not just something, oh, that looks interesting? And so please talk about what really empowered you to pursue marine biology.
That's actually a really good question, because I grew up in Wisconsin. And in case somebody doesn't know the geography of the United States, Wisconsin's pretty much landlocked in the middle of the country. And there's a lake there, but there's no ocean. And there's certainly no whales. And that's what my passion was. So I grew up, I knew I wanted to be a marine biologist from the time that I was 7 years old. And what we did, my parents would take me to Chicago to an aquarium every year on my birthday. We'd go on vacations and I would be able to go to the beach. But I didn't grow up near an ocean. So I didn't grow up knowing what I wanted to do with marine biology. I just knew that I loved whales and dolphins and wanted to learn more about them. So I, you know, grew up like that. My parents were very supportive. They, you know, had me learn how to scuba dive and let me go off scuba diving when we were on vacation, which is tough to let your, you know, teenage daughter go on this boat with strangers, but they would let me do that. And
wait, why is that tough for parents to let their that's a joke.
Oh,
continue.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter, well, I won't tell you what my daughter's done, but yeah, I usually tell me afterwards, after you're safe. But, you know, they let me do that. And then they supported me when I came out to California for graduate school. I went to undergrad in Wisconsin, kind of got my basics in zoology and biology. And they came out here for graduate school. And they were supportive of me, you know, leaving home and going to the far away for graduate school to learn more about marine biology. And that's where I really, you know, learned more about whales and learned whale watching. And it's also where I discovered that I get seasick. So I couldn't really, you know, be on a boat researching whales. I had to take seasick medicine. So it just brought up a lot of different challenges, and that led me to teaching. And I can teach about whales and dolphins and still experience it through whale watching, but with taking medicine.
So we talked over email quite a lot, and you told me that when and after the brain tumor and stroke happened, you had to readjust and really reconfigure how you would teach and still pursue your passion.
Right.
Tell,
and one
more about that process.
That's great. You know, I was at the time of my brain surgery, I did have tenure at this school. So, you know, my job was kind of safe for me to be gone. I was gone for about a year and a half. And, you know, when I came back, I knew I wanted to come back to teaching. And I knew I wanted to come back to being a marine biologist. And that's another story. And I'll tell you a little bit more about what really gave me hope that I was able to do that. When I came back, I had to, you know, learn how to navigate the campus with my different abilities. I came back and took a class at my school with, and it was an adaptive physical education class. And the instructor was very well versed in dealing with people with brain injuries. And he got me to walking again. You know, I really credit that class with getting me back to campus. And I was able to come back to campus and practice talking. My speech wasn't very good, so practice talking. Students were very supportive, and I was able to come back and modify my teaching. I did a lot of online teaching because I did not have the energy to lecture 3 times a week. I still don't. So I still do a lot of online teaching. Before it was, you know, cool because of COVID. So I modified the way that I came back and the way that I teach, but stuck to my goals and I stayed true to myself. And that was one of the mantras that I came up with when I was going through all of this. Don't be afraid to modify your goals, but always stay true to yourself. And I knew I wanted to continue teaching about whales and dolphins, but I had to modify the way that I did that. And that really helped me come back to teaching and still be true to who I was.
So you emailed me, and I'm always interested how people hear about this podcast, because unfortunately, and it shouldn't be, it's a niche market. If you look at podcasts and look at automobile cooking podcasts, dating podcasts, A to Z, you will find hundreds of thousands. But if you put in disability into the search category, more often than not, you get a very medicalized healthcare view of disability. And then when you go deeper, you only find, comparatively speaking, a very small percentage of disability-related or centric podcasts. So how did you find Disability Empowerment Now?
I actually signed up for this matching service called Podcast DB. And in this, you can search for podcasts and you can, you know, pitch the host, as I did to you, with your story and see if they connect with you. So I found you through Podcast DB. And I don't know if that was something that you signed up for or that they actually look for podcasts, but I did a search for disability or disability awareness and found you.
I will have to check that out, because right now I don't remember signing up for that. Maybe it's someone in my team did. I don't know. I'm just grateful you found me and that we started talking.
Me too.
And do you miss not being able to be on a boat, to be researching on water? Because when most people think of marine biologists, outside of teaching, they think you're on
you're
a
out on a
ship
boat.
Or in research station somewhere, researching in underwater somehow.
Right.
So, and obviously you're not. Do you miss that opportunity, or did the direction that led you to become a teacher really fulfill you in a way that you didn't expect but are grateful for?
Definitely. I mean, since I did seasick, I was not ever able to really do research on a boat, but I did have some short-term experiences that really got me in tune with that marine biology side. Plus, I always knew that I wanted a family too. So I didn't want to be, at the Galapagos Islands for months at a time. I wanted to be a mom. I wanted to be with my kids. So teaching is really the best of both worlds. Because I still do go on and about, just not regularly, not as part of my job, more as a vacation almost. I mean, I went to Alaska last summer and had an amazing experience whale watching, where the whales came right next to the boat. And it was, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything. That was an amazing experience. But that's the kind of experience that I have. I just don't have it all the time as much as a researcher would have. But, it has to be part of make it part of my life in other ways.
So what do you read to keep up with the research in data in your field? And as a teacher, what do you employ in teaching about marine biology?
Good question. I do actually look up articles, but the way that I find out about the articles, I know it doesn't sound very scientific, but a lot of it is on Facebook. Because a lot of the top researchers that I know of that I'm, seeing at conferences and I'm friends with, post their new stuff on Facebook. So when I see an article that they
imagine that,
posted, right? They posted an article, a link to an article. I'll go read that article. You get the article before it's ever published, and so you get brand new research that way. So that way I keep in touch. Plus, there's actually a website called happywhale.com. And I know that name doesn't sound very scientific, but happywhale.com is where every researcher goes to find out where the whales are. Because what that website does is they let regular people, anybody who's out whale watching, take a picture of a whale's tail, upload it to this website, and then the website uses algorithms and facial identity and identifies that whale. So you can track exactly where the whale is going throughout the world. And researchers use that. So every whale that I've ever posted, I actually get updates on when they're sighted again. So that's a great way to just keep in touch with, specific whales that I've seen. Like these whales that I saw in Alaska, I could find out exactly where they go in the winter. Because I'll get updates.
So we may have already touched on that, but there's a lot of marine life out there. Dolphins are the first to come to mind. Sharks are second, most common. What was it about whales that drew you to that specific species of marine life?
Interesting question. I'm really thinking back. I mean, it was dolphins at first. At first, it was actually fish. And what I liked about fish was that they were so free and they were doing something that I couldn't do. And that's probably where dolphins are just, since they do have to come to the surface, they're more visible, but then they go away. So it's a little bit of the mystery of them, like whales too. You only see a little bit of their body, So you're left to kind of imagine what they're doing underneath the water. And I think the curiosity of that, you know, when I look out at the ocean now, even if I don't see anything on the surface, I just know that there's so much going on underneath. And it's the mystery of what's underneath, I think, that drew me to this field partly. Plus, they're cute.
That's a very detailed answer. And it's not shocking that you'd started observing fish and then dolphins. And the point you made about the mystery of everything going underneath and wanting to know more about that is, I think, very relatable, because humans like to know.
We like to know,
But,
curious.
We're extremely curious creatures, very social as well. So, would you mind talking about the aftermath of the brain tumor and reemerging? I mean, you talked about it a little with
right.
your teaching, and that's important. And one of the main focuses. But a brain tumor, a stroke of any kind, a brain injury, they're no joke. And
right.
It takes a lot out of a person, particularly a person, to survive that and reemerge in a different way.
Right.
If you don't mind, would you share some of that journey?
Absolutely. First of all, you should know that I was in the hospital and rehab centers for almost 9 months. So this is a long time in the hospital. But one story that I have to tell you about is that one of my speech therapists, because I could barely speak, I mean, for a long time, I couldn't swallow, I couldn't eat, I couldn't move. And one of my speech therapists to work on speech, she would come into my room, and instead of having me read words on a card, like random words or random paragraphs, she would have me recite the names of the whales on a poster that I had in my room. So she would point to a whale, and I would say, you know, gray whale, humpback whale, blue whale. And then she would point to the whale again and make me say the scientific names of those whales. The Balaenoptera musculus, Megatronoviangli, Extradictus robustus. Well, you don't know if I'm saying them right. And
no,
she didn't know if I'm...
But just to interrupt, don't they roll off the tip of your tongue?
Oh yeah, they're easy,
Yeah.
you know. But that obviously got my, you know, my speech muscles working. And it did more than just speech rehab. That's what I was talking about when it gave me hope that I would get back to being a marine biologist. Now, that made me remember that I remembered all these whales. That I remember their scientific names. I mean, who does that? You know, a whale nerd like me. But, you know, I remembered these things. So I was in touch with the marine biology side of myself. And I knew that I would be able to get back to that at some point. So as I was going through my recovery, you know, being able to walk again, and I started off with just a walker, and then I switched to a cane, then nothing. But going back to onto a whale watching boat was one of the hardest things that I ever did. My first time on a whale watching boat, you know, I can barely walk without falling. And then you're walking down a dock, and the dock is moving a little bit. Picture a kid coming up behind you and jumping on the dock, so the dock moves even more. And then you got to step on the boat. Just getting onto this boat was really, really hard. And then once you're on the boat and the boat is moving, I couldn't run around the boat. I couldn't move around the boat at all when it was moving. But I could still bring my big camera, I could sit in one spot and take pictures. And that's what I did. So again, I modified my goals for how what I was going to do when I was on the boat. But I stayed true to myself. I love taking pictures of whales and dolphins. Not the best at it, but I love doing it. So I, still did it. And I still got on that boat and was able to go whale watching. And that's really how I got get back to my marine biology side is still going out on the water. And here in Pacifica, where I live near San Francisco, we've been able to see whales from shore almost every year since 2015. We've been able to see whales from shore. So I'll go out and watch whales from shore. Just go to the beach a lot and watch sunset. Just they have some connection to my marine biology side.
Talk more about that, because I've never seen a whale up close, just observing them from the beach or not on a boat. What is it like observing such an animal from the shore?
I mean, it's awesome. First of all, if they're farther away, all that you really see is the blow, which is them exhaling. They're not blowing water, they're exhaling. So all you really see is their exhale, which in some of these whales can go up to 50 feet or more. So I've seen them from, from miles and miles away. So, if you're just seeing that, people who've never seen a whale, I see them, really in awe, even if that's all they're seeing. The whales that are coming to Pacifica are here feeding. You literally see them lunge for the surface with their mouth open and then their mouth closed. And you can see little fish jumping out of their mouth. So if they're close enough, which they've been coming closer to shore, you can see body parts. And you can see part of their jaw. You can definitely see part of their back when they're swimming. You can see their tail when they're diving. So you can see the part of their body and just the knowledge that you're looking at a 50-ton animal and that's eating tiny little fish is just it's just amazing to think about and to realize that. But even if you're not that close to them, getting close to them is a whole different story. But when you get real close, you can smell their breath, which is kind of fishy, but it's great. If you're sneezed on by a whale, that's amazing. But even seeing them from a little bit farther away is just an awesome experience from people.
So tell me more about how people have reacted to the mention of impact of empathy.
When I say that, everybody needs to exhibit empathy in any situation, everybody agrees with that. And I think that the point with healthcare professionals, I do believe that they have empathy in their heart, because I'm going to assume that they wouldn't be going into this profession if they didn't have empathy. And it's expressing it that gets tough if they're having a tough day or they have limited time with people. So my workshops are more about how to express the empathy rather than how to have empathy, because I'm assuming they have it. And my idea too is that expressing it doesn't need to be that difficult. It doesn't need to be complicated, and it doesn't need to take a lot of time. It's very simple. It's a smile. It's a hand on the shoulder. It's a looking with eye contact and listening with eye contact. And it's really simple. It's just commenting on somebody's poster in their room instead of just saying, "Hi, can I have your arm for blood?" It can be a very simple thing. Like anything that can positively impact somebody else, I'll call empathy. So it's gotten a very, very positive feedback in my workshops.
What do you wish that able-bodied people knew in general about disability and people with disabilities?
I would say the first thing is that people with a disability are still like able to understand you and you can talk directly to them. And I'm sure you've had too, so many people that talk to the person that you're with and not to you.
Oh, yes, yes.
So, right. So I think acknowledging that you are a person, that you can make eye contact with that person and talk to that person is one of the most, you know, the greatest myths of people with disabilities is that you can't, especially if you don't have a smooth speech pattern, that you can't understand them. And that's, you know, the biggest myth is just we talk to like a person. I had a service dog for several years. He's still around. He's just retired. But when I would bring my service dog with me, people, including healthcare professionals, would talk to the dog and not to me. They would ask the dog if they can pet him or if he's working. And I'm like, and he's like, oh, no, I'm not working. You can pet me. You know, he's a dog. They wouldn't talk to me. They would talk to the dog. So that's another just example of people not acknowledging that you're a human if you have a disability. And that's the main thing, is to acknowledge that you're a human.
Hold on, before you go on, I was just dumbfounded by that answer.
I can tell by your response.
Yeah, unless we've now decoded the canine language into English somehow, what I can't
you're speechless.
Form the sentence. What did people think that the dog would actually say that would be comprehensible to them?
I don't know, that you know, befuddled my mind too. I don't know what people were thinking, because it was distracting to them. If I'm trying to, like, you know, check out at the grocery store and I'm holding him and somebody's saying, talking to him, he's getting distracted. And then I'm distracted from what I'm doing because I have to, you know, correct his behavior because he's not supposed to react if somebody's talking to him. But he's a dog. Of course he's going to react. So it was very frustrating. And, you know, I would tell people, that's like taking somebody's wheelchair away from them or taking their walker. Would you walk up to somebody and take their walker away from them, or their cane or their wheelchair? No. And that's what a service dog, I mean, that's what a service dog, that's what their role is. Their role is as one of your tools they're using to aid your disability. So why would they take that away from you? By distracting them. And he was happy. That was the comment I got too, that I'm like abusing him, making him work. And dogs, you know, like to work. And he was like the happiest service dog. He just, you know, when we're out in public, he's a service dog. And he's still so happy. He loved me, so happy to be with me and help me. And there was no way that this is abusive at all.
Let's go back to that comment, because what was it like to hear that? I'm assuming time and time and time again. And then what do you say to answer that question that is so ridiculous? Ridiculous. It defies comprehension. First, they talk to the dog like the dog can actually understand them and give a response that they can understand.
Right,
and
right.
Then they turn to you and tell you that
you're
must be abusing the dog, making him work, because otherwise he's the happiest dog on the planet. I'm really interested how a person would handle those situations.
It's a tough one, and usually when somebody says something negative like that to you, they say it and then they run away. You don't have a chance to respond. If they would talk to the dog, I would say, you can talk to me. But again, you know, if I wasn't talking clearly or talking as quickly as they were, they wouldn't listen to me. It was frustrating. And you just have to kind of shake it off, go write a blog about it, and, you know, get your frustrations out in writing, since you can't answer them. Although I have waited for somebody once honked at me when I was crossing a parking lot with my dog, because I was walking too slow. And I waited for this person to go park and come up, and then I yelled at them. So that felt good. You can, once in a while, you can get your say your piece, but usually they're gone, and they're faster than me, so they're gone.
So beyond those two questions, which still defy comprehension, and what are some other things that you wish that able-bodied people would know and appreciate about a person with a disability?
I mean, I would say understanding that the disability doesn't define you. It's not who you are. It's just one thing about you. And I've, you know, after this discussion about whales, you obviously get that that's not, you know, having a disability is not the primary focus of my life. And that's the thing. It's not the primary focus of my life. I take a CrossFit class on Zoom, run, you know, for a disability community, but still I'm able to go and do other things and work out. And I think that's what the big, another myth is. Also, you know, that I'm not drunk. People think, have said, and assume that I'm drunk because of the way that I'm walking. So, you know, having a little bit of just opening your mind a little bit, that somebody with a disability is more than just somebody with a disability. They're also a person who does other things.
I'm sorry. I'm getting animated because I have experienced that exact same thing, except not really regarding my walk, but the speech. People often think I'm either drunk, on drugs, or something entirely different. And the drunk thing, it doesn't help that I'm half Irish. And so the assumptions people make are, I mean, some are well-meaning, not the ones we're discussing, of course, but you can't paint them all with a broad stroke, but you shouldn't paint them with a thin stroke, too. So, where to go from here? Because you said that, and you're right, most of this episode has been about your passion, which is
both
biology and teaching, and combining that with advocating for fostering more empathy towards other humans. What do you do in your free time? You mentioned that you're into CrossFit.
I do CrossFit one hour a day. I really like watching football and basketball. So I watch a lot of like the 49ers and the Golden State Warriors. Those are my two teams around here. So I watch a lot of sports and hang out with my family, hang out with my kids. I do hang out with my kids.
If you don't mind me asking, what's your family like? And I'm sure they were nothing but supportive during the brain tumor and surgery that accompanied. But how did your friends and family, those that know you the best, react to the change? And how did they help you reemerge into the person you are today?
I mean, it was huge. Because first of all, my family, you know, I'm from Wisconsin. My family lives all over the country. So they came in. My sister from San Diego came up a lot when I was in the hospital and, you know, talked to my doctors and really took care of things for me. But, and friends, I mean, I was gone from my house. I was a single mom and all of a sudden plucked out of my house. My kids had to go live with their dad. My dogs were here alone. My friends really stepped up and took care of my house and took care of my dogs and took care of my kids. They got my house ready for me before I came home, like installed more safety bars. And at one point there was some sort of a leak in my, like a pipe broke into my backyard. I don't even know the details about it because they took care of it. So they really took care of things while I was gone. And then, you know, coming back, and this is what I would tell anybody who has a disability or who needs help, don't be afraid to ask for it. Don't be afraid to ask for help when you need it. We all do things for other people, and it's not a shameful thing to need help. And that's a really, really hard thing for most people who are independent, who suddenly have a disability, that they suddenly need help with things that they didn't need help with before. And don't be afraid to ask for specific things. And also, if somebody offers help, don't be afraid to say yes, please. Do that. On the other hand, if you have a friend going through this tough time, offer specific things. Don't say, call me if you need anything, because they're not going to call you. You know, instead say, I'm going to the grocery store. Do you want to go with and pick some things up? Or do you want me to pick some things up for you? You know, offer something specific. That's harder to say, oh, no, I'm okay, because they're not okay. They need help. So that's another thing that everybody can do. Anybody who's, you know, needing the help, don't be afraid to ask for it. Anybody who's got a friend who needs help, don't be afraid to offer it. Offer specific things.
So if there are any aspiring advocates or marine biologists or aspiring teachers wanting to explore their fields more deeply, what would be some advice you would give them as they're just branching out into their respective fields?
Right. One thing that I say is get experience in that field. You know, if you're going to want to be a marine biologist of some sort, it's a tough field to find a job in. But you want to go volunteer for things and see what you like. You know, go volunteer at a marine mammal rehab hospital. Go volunteer to work on some of these research projects. They all want volunteers. So, you know, volunteer for things that will tell you whether you like it. And, you know, the person that you're volunteering for, you can look at them and see how they got there. You can use them as a role. Find somebody who's got the job that you want when you grow up. and see how they got there. So look at different people's stories of how they got there. And volunteering with any field you want to go into, volunteer is going to help you get the experience that you need to get into that field.
So I like to think that both people with disabilities and those who have yet to discover and embrace their own disabilities listen to this podcast. It would be naive to think that both groups take exactly the same things away from every episode I do with my guests. So as my guests, what do you hope that people with disabilities take away from everything we've talked about in this episode? And what do you hope that, And what do you hope that people who have yet to discover and embrace their own disabilities take away from this episode?
I would say you need to have hope that you can stay true to yourself. And the four mantras that I live by, which are also, you can see them on my website, impactofempathy.net. And those are just ways of getting through those tough times. And realize that it's okay to have tough times. It's okay to be sad, even depressed, but you don't want to stay there. You want to use the mantras and use whatever tools you have to bring yourself out of it and realize that you have a life outside of your disability. And that's, I think, the most important thing. You don't have to be, you are not your disability. You have a disability is one part of you, but it doesn't need to define you. You can be interested in other things, whether it's, you know, sports, whales, dolphins, whatever it is, art, photography, whatever you love, you can still love if you have a disability.
What if someone is very adamant that their disability does define them and that they aren't, that doesn't bother them, because there are people who do have that connection to their disability identity. What do you hope that they take away from this episode?
I think that a lot of people who are see themselves as defined by their disability, a lot of the people that I've met like that are also trying to educate others about their disability, and they're talking about their disability. So in reality, they're not defined by their disability. They're helping others. That's part of what's defining them. So I think there's always something that you can latch onto, but you know, if your disability is what defines you, and there's any way that you can give back to a community of people that have your disability, that's another thing that you're doing that's not part of your disability.
So what do you hope that people who have yet to discover or embrace their own disabilities take away from everything that we've talked about in this episode?
Right. It's a really tough transition. And I will say that I wrote a book about my whole story called When Life Throws You Lemons, Make Cranberry Juice. So if you'd like to, you know, see what I was feeling at that time. Because I had some really dark times and dark days. And I think that it's really important to acknowledge that it's a really tough transition. But here I am 17 years later, a little bit more comfortable in who I am and, you know, that part of myself. But that's a really tough transition. I think that acknowledging that you're going to go through that tough time, not sweeping it under the rug, but acknowledging that, but also acknowledging that there are moments of levity. Even when you're going through that dark time, you can still watch, you know, an old episode of Seinfeld and laugh. And that's something that's not part of your disability. So I think finding any break from it while you're going through this transition, any break from what you're going through will later help you deal with what you're going through. You have to deal with it. It's going to be tough, but breaking it up into sections is going to make it a little bit more manageable.
Well, Jerry, I have enjoyed this interview immensely. I feel very honored to know you, and I hope you will come back and talk to me again.
Sure will. I'd love to.
About your journey and your philosophy on living with a disability and adapting to it and not allowing it, in your words, to define you, but have it be an important part of your journey just the same.
Right,
did I get that correct?
Yes, and you've actually made me think a lot, because these are questions that I've never been asked before. So it really made me think a lot, and I realized as I talk about it that it is true that I'm not defined by my disability. Nobody would, and nobody who knows me would say, oh, that's Jerry. People who didn't know me before might say she's a brain tumor person. But most people would say she's the 49er fan who likes whales. You know, so that it doesn't define me. And that's one thing that I'm really realizing that as I get more comfortable with who I am.
Well, I very much appreciate this chance to interview you, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, Keith.
You have been listening to Disability Empowerment Now. I would like to thank my guests, you, our listener, and the Disability Empowerment team that made this episode possible. More information about the podcast can be found at disabilityempowermentnow.com or on our social media at Disability Empowerment Now. The podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts or on the official website. Don't forget to rate, comment, and share the podcast. This episode of Disability Empowerment Now is copyrighted 2024.